Welcome to Paint Ed. PCA provides painting contractors with connections they need to grow their business. To find out more and to become a member, visit pcapainted.org. Find more great content like this on PCA Overdrive. A subscription to the platform is included with membership. For all of you non-members out there, sign up for a free trial. PCA Overdrive is available on the App Store and Google Play.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Contract Revolution. This is Benji. If you've ever wondered how an open book management business operates and whether or not this model might work for you, you're in luck. Open book management, or OBM for short, is a business philosophy and system that communicates the entire financial picture of the business to everyone inside it, all the way down to the laborer in the field. The fundamental idea being every set of hands comes with it a free brain, and people generally play better when you're keeping score. Our guest on the show today is Ryan Markowicz, the founder of Creative Roots Landscaping in Kelowna, BC, and he's also a certified Great Game of Business coach. For the last 20 years, he has run Creative Roots fully open book and is here today to tell us a bit about it. So I ask him a bunch of stuff. I ask him, does OBM really work, or is this just another hyped up business framework? How much extra effort is it to train employees on the financial reports and KPIs and critical numbers in order for them to be truly in the game? And I ask them how they select future partners from their employee pool. How do they groom them? And what does it actually mean when an employee purchases a chunk of the company? How does all that work? Open book management is not for everyone, but if you've ever been just curious about it, this is a great jumping off point. So without further ado, let's dive in with Ryan.
You're watching Contractor Evolution, where we unpack the systems, tactics, and skills you need to take your fast-growing contracting business to the next level.
You're here to learn what it takes to scale up, work less, and increase profitability. You've come to the right place.
Stay tuned to learn what separates the new breed of contractor from the old school, and welcome to your ultimate guide on the business of contracting.
Ryan, it's good to see you, man. Another Kelowna native. Thanks for coming on the show. I'm excited to talk to you today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So
it's a great podcast.
Thank you. Well, thank you. And you're about to make it better. We'll start with an easy one. I want you to paint the picture for our listeners of what your current business life is like. In other words, like, how involved are you with Creative Roots?
Okay. It might be easier to start on how much different it is than what it used to be.
Sure.
As opposed, you know, which is pretty typical, an owner working the 14, 16, and I hate to say it, 18-hour days for many, many years. That the tide changed considerably when I started to involve my employees a lot more in the running of the business itself, based on the notion that the company was the actual product. We just happened to do landscaping, and it just changed the mindset about what we had to do to create a valuable company, mm-hmm. A place where people wanted to be, and and just kind of freed our mind up to do a little more things related to our work, be more creative. So my day to day now is I still have some roles, and you could find me sweeping the shop floor or playing around with the compost pile out back. I do some plant layouts still, and my role is more related to. There's no schedule for my role. Mm. It's when I want to give to the team, and when I can add value, I do. But I'm not expected to be around.
Well, you know, our mutual friend Mark Bradley has described you as redundant in your business. Would you say that that's apt? Is that a fair descriptor?
Well, that wasn't very nice of him, was it?
No, redundant in a good way.
Yeah. For most things, I would say that the business absolutely does not need me to do well. In fact, I think, you know, looking forward to our 2030 vision, which is about 165% growth from where we are today in both people and revenue and et cetera, I think they would be better off if I just contributed here and there and just let them run with it.
Well, I want to share a little anecdote just for our listeners to kind of paint the picture here. you know, I've gotten to know Ryan over the last couple of months. I went over to the shop the other day and we did a bit of a tour. He showed me all the dashboards. He showed me all the open book management stuff. Much of it we're going to get into later in this conversation. And because I'm sort of like a business nerd, I've become curious about things and I'll ask, what about this? Who does the recruiting? Where do you guys post your job ads? Like blah, all this stuff. And like every time you'd look at me, you go, you know, Benji, I honestly don't know. I honestly don't. That's something you'd have to ask the team about. And I share that little quip because it really paints the picture. We talk a lot about stepping back, getting out of the day-to-day, being less involved, letting our team lead things, et cetera. And I think a lot of the times we give it lip service. I was blown away at how often you answered that question. Sincerely, totally honest. I actually don't know because it's not my job anymore. This is something that someone else does. So that's just a good little way to sort of prove the point. You are largely uninvolved, and we mean that in a good way. And you've done that through open book management, which is the conversation we're going to have today. I want to ask you a question that I'm sure a skeptical listener has right now, which is like, you know, Ryan, open book management, does that really work? What do you say to that when you're confronted with that question?
I say it 100% works if you want it to. When I stumbled across the book that led me down this path and I learned more about it, I just said I couldn't find a more common sense option or I had never heard of anything that made so much sense. And so I was hooked on it. So, you know, it's just one of those things that, you know, anything positive in your life, anything greatly positive usually starts with a positive belief. And I 100% believe that it would work. So we went with it and then we made it work.
For the uninformed, can you, like in a nutshell, I'm talking like couple minute here, not because there's a lot to it. So I just want like the true synopsis. For the uninformed, can you explain what open book management is in a nutshell?
Okay. So I think there's a lot of variations of it. And I know I've heard this in different articles and people talking about it. But for me, it goes beyond just open book reporting, or talking the numbers with your management team. The way we do it is we drive the financial literacy and the education and the involvement right to the front line. From the first day someone starts, they're involved in team-wide meetings. And so I like to say that originally it was the concept of open book finance. And so you had this thing where it was a financial thing. And yes, that is mostly what open book management is known for. But there's also the management aspect to it that drives the culture as well. So not only getting people involved in understanding the numbers that they drive and support every day, and giving them a stake in the outcome, but also the culture. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're not having enough fun, whose fault is that? You know, and who can make that better? So getting the team involved in an open way on all levels of running the business and just teaching them the real realities of the marketplace and how those realities change from year to year. And there's no one recipe in business, Benji. I'm sure you've talked to so many people, you know, what works for one person isn't exactly what's going to work for the next. So I find in the whole notion of open book management, we'll get into the high moment planning, I'm sure, in this conversation, is that we're really using a system and it's a rinse and repeat system that we do on an annual basis that just brings us back to the current realities of the marketplace, gains the opinion from the players who are out on the field every day, and then creates a plan and a strategy. And then we go out and execute.
I was really struck by how visual your shop is. When I walked around it, there are like physical dashboards that are updated with chalk or a whiteboard or whatever. There's sort of critical number dashboards. There's gross profit drivers. There's quarterly updates. There's just a vast amount of information that would typically be held somewhere in like the management folder of a business, held away from the rest of the team. But this is something that like the newest tech who's just been hired last week and is still going going through onboarding can walk through and see, like, literally down to the penny how much money the business made last week and why. I was quite awestruck by just how visual and in your face so much of the data is.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to do it the other way. And I just couldn't even imagine going back. In fact, I've heard that so many times from employees over the years. It's like, I don't know if I could go work for a company that didn't share this stuff anymore.
Yeah.
So it tells the story. Like, you think about, you have players on the field or on the basketball court or wherever they are, and you didn't put the score up until 2 minutes before the game and you lost by a basket.
Yeah.
And what would the players say? They would say, I wish I would have known the score. I would have passed or over to Benji, or I would have run a little harder. You know, when we know the score in real time, and let's be honest, the true scoreboards of business are the financials.
When did you clue into this whole notion, this whole methodology, and why? Like, what was going on in your business life at the time that had you looking for answers?
That's a good question. So I started in 1994. And about 2005 or so, yeah, I think we were probably already doing $1.3 million in sales, and had, I don't know, maybe 18 full-time people. And I was making plenty for a guy that didn't have much education and started with a lawnmower and a truck. But, you know, I wasn't happy. And I just remember talking to a friend of mine. He said, well, you should learn how to run the business as opposed to it running you. And for a moment, I was disappointed in him, and then I was disappointed in myself. But I said, hey, what do you suggest? And he said, hey, look, I heard about this book in my EO group. Why don't you grab a bunch of copies and, you know, read it, and read it with your team, a chapter a week type thing. So I read it and I said, man, it just makes a whole lot of sense. It's just, it was a story about the evolution of open book management from the actual pioneers of it, the Great Game of Business. And it's an interesting
story.
That's
the book, The Great Game of Business,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, The Great Game of Business.
Stack. Okay.
Was the original one. And really, realistically, it was just a story of one of the largest and most successful turnarounds in American history in business. And so they had this thing down in Springfield, Missouri, where their factory was. And they had to come up with a name for their business that was teaching other people how they were doing good business. And it was called The Great Game of Business. And so I jumped on an airplane and I went down there for a 2-day experience. And I walked the factory floors. I listened to Jack Stack talk. They ran us through some, you know, just some workshops. And I said, yeah, I got to do this. And so I put the book in my lunch kit and I carried it around for like 4 years. And whether I read it or not, it was going to be a part of what we were going to do, no matter what. And I'm sure glad I stuck through it because, you know, it wasn't always easy.
But you said, I wasn't happy. I was 10 years into my business. I wasn't happy. Can you remember like what some of the real like pain points or what was kind of breaking your heart as a business owner that you were trying to fix?
Well, one thing is I didn't like to cycle through people.
Okay.
And I had tried different profit sharing things and, you know, I would promise a profit on a little project. Well, then someone would back the skid steer to the corner of the house on a different one. Then I would tell the other project I couldn't pay for it, the profit share. And it's like, it always led to bad feelings, you know, on the profit share side. And people didn't even know when or what they were going to get. So, as part of the open book management, the way the Great Game does it, there's a way to build a profit gain sharing program where the team really understands where they stand in real time and they can make that difference. In addition to that, I was just tired. I took on everything. I thought it was my job to make sure all the company events were fun and stuff like that. Little did I know once I let it go that, I really wasn't that fun. And, those things that the business owner thinks they have to do it all and they really don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. I like that comment about, just, sort of the revolving door of staff really broke your heart and you saw this as a way to keep people for longer, if not forever, at least keep them for longer. Okay, I want to get into some of these core concepts, but before we do, I got to talk about my wardrobe today. This is really exciting. I've got some great gear from one of our favorite members, Will Brown, Brown Boys Roofing. He's been on the podcast. I think it was one of our first 10 episodes. If you scroll way back. So I always ask whenever I like have our members' gear on, I always ask for a bit of a highlight, bit of a low light, bit of their story. So I'll just tell you a bit about Will Brown very, very briefly for our listeners. Residential roofing, gutters, and solar. They've been Breakthrough Academy members since 2018. They started working with Coach Braden, but they are now working with Coach Dan Stav in our Master's Circle group. That's our high performance group, invite only group. They're based in Bentonville, Arkansas. And I asked him for just sort of a bit of a summary or a challenge they're working on in their business. And so here's what he said. We're tightening up on overhead spending. When cash flow is great, I haven't paid close enough attention to spending. Haha, revenue hides a lot of problems. Time to correct that. I shared with our team that we needed to get our spending under control after I completed the Q3 review. I started by sharing the why to the whole team, and we did everything we could as a team to reduce our spending. After completing our monthly reviews of January and February, I compared our overhead spending to that same period last year, and we have been able to cut about $78,000. I don't know if that's per month or just in total. Probably just in total. That seems like a pretty high overhead. But they've cut almost 80 grand in overhead. The easy answer is to say communicate the why. But the reality is that without a strong team and culture, they likely won't get the job done. Ryan, any comments on like just managing overhead, a bloated overhead, how to keep it small? Any comments on this thing that Will's mentioned?
Well, it sounds like Will's actually could be doing open book management there. I love that. You know, it's step two in implementing the Great Game of Business, or, you know, open book management. The way I do it is share the why before the how, because people get a lot more excited about the how when they understand the why, especially when that why has come up in a team format. And that's kind of, you know, just harnessing, I guess it would be, say, harnessing or tapping into the universal desire of people's need to win.
Yeah.
People want to win. They really do. As for the overhead, keep an eye on your overhead. I mean, that's what I'm saying. There's a different recipe for each business, but it's not just for each business. It's per year.
It creeps up and up and up and up. And before you know it, you've got a whole, this massive weight over top of you waiting to drop. I think that's really smart. I think a lot of listeners should clue into what Will's saying and do a bit of a fixed expenses audit, a bit of an overhead audit, and see if there's anything there you can trim. We talked about that a few weeks ago on our predictions episode. Guys, if you're listening and you want to work with contractors like Will in Brown Boys Roofing, there's over 600 members just like him. We systemize contracting businesses for growth. So if you're a fan of the show, you're going to love Breakthrough Academy. You can check us out. I'll put a link on the screen or in the description somewhere. Let's get back to the conversation with Ryan.
Well, here, just one more sure. thing on that, Benji. You know, the fact that they were able to cut out that amount of money leaves more. I don't know what kind of profit sharing he does, or if he does do any, but when people understand that they're cutting that out to leave more, you know, for the company, which in turn could turn into profit sharing, you know, it changes the threshold. And so that's important too. And people get a lot more excited. It's almost gamifying it. You can really gamify that whole thing. Hey, let's find the leaks in the boat.
Totally. They're a little more motivated to find the cost cutting and find the efficiencies. I picked like three. I want to maybe preface the rest of the conversation with this. Like, open book management is an entire discipline and methodology, and it's not a small undertaking to do it. It's well worthwhile, but it's not small. So we can't like in a 45-minute or hour-long podcast cover the entire gamut of things. So I've just cherry picked a few of the fundamental tenets that I thought we could talk about and ask a few questions around that help explore this, knowing full well that if someone were to take this very seriously, they would need to go and do their own education beyond this podcast. But there's a few things I wanted to ask you about that really leapt off the page, and I was skimming both the Great Game of Business and Get in the Game. One of the ideas that shared a lot is this one. It's called Open the Books and Teach the Numbers. So what does that mean, first of all? And then what's like the overarching philosophy behind it? Open the books and teach the numbers.
Yeah. So I would say what we want to do is we want to teach people just how difficult it is to make profit and to run a business. And that's the reality of it. I mean, Benji, I mean, any one of your contractors in your BTA, if I challenge them to walk up to a team of their employees and ask them how much is left after all said and done, net operating profit out of every dollar, you know, what do you think that as a percentage, what do you think that range is going to be?
What do I think the employees would guess?
Yeah.
Oh, I think they'd way overestimated.
Yeah.
I think they'd say there's like, you know, 60% goes directly to your wallet or something.
Yeah. And I've heard, I do this with every company I've worked with. We do it within internally in our own company. And it's that 10 to 80%.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we did $1 million in sales. I've got 800,000 left over at the end.
Right.
But people just don't know. Yeah. And I don't want employees who are out there on the front line making or breaking my entire business not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't put people out on the court or the soccer pitch or anything. You can't have them out there unless they know the rules of the game, and the financials are part of that. So, you know, we don't do a lot of, highly formalized training. We do have some formalized training, but most of it's just in tidbits. It's in conversation. It's surrounding the scoreboards that you saw when you were in our shop And so that's it. We just want to teach people the realities of business.
How transparent are you really with, like, how much can they really see?
Yeah. Okay. So they can see pretty much everything with the exception of individual wages.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and we don't actively share the balance sheet or the cash flow statement. But if that was one of our critical numbers, then we would. It just doesn't happen to be, and it hasn't ever happened to be. But sometimes we will have discussions surrounding what the actual balance sheet and cash flow statement are and how they're used to help us run the business more effectively.
But other than that, it's all free reign. They can see sales, they can see revenue, they can see variable expenses, gross profit, they can see what you spend on overhead, they can see what you spend on marketing, they can see your net, they can see your EBITDA, like it's all there.
Yeah, and you saw that in those scoreboards. Yeah, our scoreboards on a departmental basis.
Mm-hmm.
They have a meeting every 2 weeks departmentally that run from revenue to gross profit.
Mm-hmm.
And then the alternating week, which is, I think, one time per month. Sorry, I might be a bit redundant here. But I think it's one time per month now. We used to do it every week. All departments come into one room and we funnel the gross profit and take it all the way to net operating profit.
How much work is truly involved with training employees, like at the early stages, to understand this stuff? Does that get annoying or frustrating? Do you get blank stares? Do they seem to really get it? And does it click for them? Like, how much work is it? Because you're moving quick. You're in the landscaping business. You want to onboard someone who can get onto a job site in the next week or 10 days and start producing revenue for you effectively. And now I have to teach them what gross profit means and how it's different than net profit. I got to explain to them these different financial reports that we look at. Like, it seems like an extra bunch of education that needs to be done. So what are your comments on that?
I would say it's a lot easier than teaching them how to do a compound grade around a pool deck of pavers, but
may be true.
Yeah. We're not ramming it down anyone's throat. It's, there are some aspects, video aspects. There's some easy reading and training in the onboarding process, which is a 90-day process for a new employee. There's also a lot of mentoring going on. Mm-hmm. There's no expectation for them to participate in those huddles other than attend at that time. So, you know, it's honestly, it's individually based. I've had people for 2-3 years sometimes that we would ask a question and they look like a deer in a headlight. And then the next person has been there for a week and they're asking, hey, how does depreciation affect this? I never heard of that before. And, you know, and so you're just constantly finding little ways to help train your people and gamify it. You know, here's one. I was down on the coast the other day. I think I told you I was doing some plant shopping for the team. And I took a video and I explained what was in the truck and the trailer. And I was driving back from the coast and I sent the video and a note. It was a game. I said, anybody with Price is Right rules, how much do you think this load of plants cost?
Right.
I had from 6,000 to 30. And the answer was 4.
Wow.
Big I'm a variance. Pretty thrifty shopper.
You're a thrifty shopper. That's a good deal.
So, but you know what that told me when I play these games or when we find people who aren't getting it, it's like, we have to do a better job. We have to do a better job and find easier ways to teach people what's actually happening in the business. And this was a new one for them, so I didn't dwell on it.
But it's not like day one, they have to sit down and do, you know, watch like 6 hours of accounting videos. And like, it's more like the stuff is there. You teach them on the go. There's a lot of tribal knowledge passed verbally from a more senior employee to a newer employee. And they kind of get the hang of things as they get onboarded.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. Yeah. Thank you for answering that. That's kind of what I was wondering. I was like, man, it seems like a whole whack load of new curriculum that a new employee needs to learn in addition to their actual job. What do you think? Because you've done this in your own business and now you help other businesses do this in theirs. What fears do entrepreneurs generally need to get over in order to really do this effectively? Are there common patterns you see, common things that business owners are scared of when they kind of make the leap?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's the same. It's the absolute polar opposite of what you actually need to be successful in this as a leader, which is you'd have to believe that, you know, that people want to do well and that that they are capable of learning. And that given the information, they will make better decisions. By giving them a stake in the outcome, they will perform better. So I think some of the, on the other side of that, leading more to your question, Benji, is, you know, you hear it's like, well, what happens if, you know, they take this information to a competitor or something like that? And I've yet to find a space in my mind where that's an issue. I always go back to you train them and they leave, or you don't train them and they stay. I mean, what's worse? Mm-hmm. And so I think the same thing goes with the financials. The bottom line is I want the people working with me to know how to make money.
Right.
For me, for them, which produces a better product. It forces us to live up to our brand promise of making neighbors jealous since 1994. It just forces us to do the things that are going to build a stronger company. And the more hands we have lifting at that level, the better, you know, the better chances are that we're going to reach that.
One of the fears would be, I think, a very common one, and perhaps it's uninformed, but I think it's common. And I'm sure a listener has it as they're driving around in the truck listening to this. You'd be like, well, I'm actually a little nervous to share with the team how much money the business makes.
Right.
Because then they're going to make an assumption about how much I take home. And you know what? That might be true. There could be someone here who's built a really good little business. And they're making 4 or 5 times what their highest paid employee is. And you know, that's the reward that you get for taking the risk of being an entrepreneur. But you can understand why someone in that situation might feel a little sheepish about going full transparency on that with a bunch of their employees who up until this point may not have known that.
100%. And I totally sympathize and understand that. So part of the education that we really try to instill is that you get paid for what you do, you get a return for what you own. I mean, that's just the way that we have an asset. That's my asset. You know, now we have 4 other employees who have turned owners. That's their asset. They're going to get a return because they have a stake, they have skin in the game. And so that's there are some basic adult conversations that need to be had. And so, and you know what? There are owners that might be taking too much relative to their employees. I'm not going to judge that. Everyone has their own thing. I'm going to read here something for you.
Sure.
that as you say. So in my book, Get in the Game Participant Workbook, it says, warning, the great game of business isn't for everyone. It says, if you're not ready to learn, teach, share, and be involved, the game isn't for you. If you have something to hide or want to use the numbers and information to manipulate and control people, find another approach.
Right. Okay, that's pretty clear.
But if you're interested in improving the results and the lives of the people helping drive those results, the game is exactly what you might need. Yeah. And I've seen it in my employees. You met a couple of them down at the LMN conference in Orlando. They're just 2 and 3 year old, 3 year employees. And you know,
hyper engaged. I never told you this. I was sitting, before I was formally introduced to them, I happened to sit in the same hot tub with them at that resort for 10-20 minutes.
Yeah.
And I had my headphones in. I was kind of in my own world and I took my headphones out and I love to do people watching and eavesdropping and conversation. And these two guys, without you there, did 25 minutes of hammering out some detail about how material should be loaded or not loaded in or out of the shop with beers in the hot tub at this landscaping conference in Orlando. I was just like, I don't know how many 2 year or 3 year employees are really putting their heads together in the hot tub to solve business problems while they're in the off season. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I just, little anecdote, but kudos to you and kudos to them. The proof was in the pudding. I never told you that. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. You want to know what the game's like? Ask the players. Yeah. And I wish we could have them.
We should have had
them
on for the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay, that kind of answers my questions about sharing the numbers. This next thing, and you've alluded to it, is high involvement planning. And it is literally called that. I think there's an acronym HIP in the overall framework, high involvement planning. What does the high involvement planning process look like in general? What does it look like for you guys at Creative Roots?
Yeah, so high involvement planning in general is, it consistently involves, informs, and educates people in the organization about the realities of the marketplace, where we are currently. And it always links back to long-term objectives and medium-term goals and short-term strategies. And it's put in a way that everyone in the organization can align and support them because they actually help create them. And I don't mean that we're taking everybody on staff on a 3-day annual offsite and doing this, but through a series of annual questions, through an employee town hall where the employees only are hashing out potential opportunities or issues related to the financial, the marketplace, the operations, or the people aspect of our business, we start to identify our critical numbers. People call them KPIs or metrics or goals, whatever you want to call them. We call them critical numbers. And then we just start finding a way that to make sure that we're focused on the right thing on an annual basis, that that focus is going to support along the longer term objective. Mm-hmm. And we're typically looking out a minimum of 5 years, mm-hmm. a minimum.
What's the actual, and we don't need to get too far down the rabbit hole, but what are the steps involved with doing this? You mentioned there's team surveys that get sent out and then answered. Right. And then there's you called it a town hall meeting. Can you maybe just give us the 3 to 5 main points of a high involvement planning process? How long does it take? What are the steps? That kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, it's weighted a little more in the fall. And before our season ends, but it's kind of an all year thing. Mm-hmm. And so we need to have a game plan. We need to have a strategy for growth. We need to have a sales plan. We need a financial plan, and we need a people plan. So those things kind of revolve around the center, which is buy-in. Mm-hmm. If people don't buy into the plan for the business moving forward, they won't engage. If they don't engage, they won't execute. If they don't execute, we won't win. Mm-hmm. And so that's in a nutshell, the pieces of high involvement planning. And just through a series of, I guess we call them huddles or meetings set up at various stages, and through questionnaires and through just conversation, we do the SWOT analysis and we do the impact versus effort matrix. And, You know, we use some of the same tools I bet you a lot of your contractors do.
Is this largely or entirely driven by them? Like, are you leading these high involvement planning meetings? Who's kind of driving them? That seems like a typical owner's job, but in your setup, I suspect it's different.
Yeah. So I'm not involved at all. Basically, I sat in on half of a 1 day one in the fall, but Colette, who's an owner, would typically come up with the structure. You know, he has have the agenda and sends out the meeting, the huddle reminders, and gets everybody in place. You know, orders the pizza for lunch, that type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, to sustain the game though, and I'm gonna go off. It's not off track here, but there's three aspects to the game, Benji. One is design it. You know, the second is play it. The third is sustain it. And so the high involvement planning is that third level. Mm-hmm. That's where you need to sustain the game. That's the thing you need to do in order to keep it relative mm-hmm. to the players. And so it doesn't go stale mm-hmm. because that's, so does that help? Mm-hmm.
No, it totally does. And I think the fundamental idea of sustaining it is people generally care more about stuff they helped create.
Yeah.
And that's not unique to this no. framework. I mean, that's something that you'll hear a lot of strategic planning experts and books and leadership sort of gurus talk about, just involving the team with the strategic planning process, or in this case, the high involvement planning process. Do you find it difficult not to step in? Like, are you tempted sometimes to sort of get in and share your own ideas or put your own mark on the process at various stages?
Not as much anymore. That, you know, the addiction to being involved with everything is kind of has wavered a bit, and I just know that things are in good hands, and I do get the gentle reminder once in a while from from other owners, or and I get to read the crowd, because I did start the business. I do have the personality that wants to answer every question in the room, all that type of stuff, and so I'm able to read the crowd, and I mean this is our 30th year, mm-hmm. so I've pretty much made every mistake that one could make. And right now I've shown them where the brass rings are, and they've grasped them, and they're going to run with them.
What do you do, and what about the employees who just simply don't care? Like, there's got to be some people who are, you know, just worker bees, and high involvement planning sounds nice, Ryan, but I'd rather play video games or go rock climbing, or I'm just here for a paycheck. Is there room for people like that in your organization? Is there space made for that kind of worker as well? Or does everyone need to be involved with this process?
Yeah, you're always going to have someone who's quiet or just isn't in a place in their life where this is resonating with them. And so, and we're good with that. You know, as long as they're not detracting from the culture, mm-hmm. Then we're totally fine. We want to put our best foot forward. I have a strong belief that anybody can be a businessman. I used to joke with the team. It's like, you know, I'll make a business person out of that. They won't even know that it's happening to them. Right. And we'll sneak it up on them. And next thing you know, they're asking questions in the huddle that you wouldn't hear from a 22-year-old or a 25-year-old.
Interesting.
And it's fun.
Yeah, I bet. I'm sure you get quite a kick out of that. Turning a landscape technician into a true owner. It's a good segue to this. This last thing I wanted to ask you about is like the partnership track, is how the cap table looks and works for you guys. Can you just talk about what it looks like at Creative Roots to become a partner? How Sure. do they get selected? How do they buy in? I mean, it's got to be quite an involved process.
Well, I can just walk you through how it happened. And so, you know, there was a point in time where I thought I was going to sell the business, and I had two employees who had been with me for, you know, 13, 14 years. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll exit. I had some other things to do. I wanted to do some business coaching, some property development. I love traveling. I spend my winters in Mexico, and I just didn't want as much responsibility anymore. So I said, yeah, I'll sell to them 50-50. And, you know, went on for about a year or two as we, you know, batted the idea around. And it ended up being that, you know, I came to the conclusion that it doesn't have to be equal ownership. and that they couldn't afford to buy me out. And so I kind of did this last man standing type analysis. Who would that be? I took the person that I thought would be the last man standing, and I gave them the opportunity to buy the largest portion of the company. And I knew that wasn't going to be me. And so, you know, we've learned along the way, but in essence, when the company, when someone wants to sell shares, like I have been, and I'm only a 20% owner at this point, or the company has grown and we need to dilute the shares in order to get someone in because they've earned it, then we value the company, and we use a very low multiple with the addition of a book value of assets because we want to make it easy for people to come in. And we know that.
Can you share what that is, or is that private? Like the multiple?
No, not at all, not at all. So, you know, and we've changed that in our second tranche of selling. We changed that, but basically, we take a 2x annual earnings average of 3 years, but we weight it to last year. So 50% to the previous year, 30% to the year before, 20% to the year before, and because we're showing current trends. We use a 2x multiple of that, and we add on the book value of assets.
That seems super generous.
You know what? Here's the thing you got to know is it the only person that ever gets hurt. I shouldn't say hurt. That is the wrong thing to say. Typically, it's just the one owner or an owner's group who wants to maximize their sale.
Yeah.
Yeah. They want to do that because they want the market value for it. And hey, my hat's off to them. I didn't care about that. I didn't need a lot. I was fine with everything else I had. And what I learned is that as long as the valuation going in is the same as it is going out, it's always fair.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, yeah. And so what we did with our team was because if they couldn't, you know, if they couldn't afford the whole value, the whole amount, or they couldn't get a loan for the whole amount of shares they were going to buy, they had to come up with 25% down. The balance of that 75%, I financed.
Right.
Yeah. And I charge, you know, an interest rate for the financing. They pay me back 80% of their dividends annually until the loan is paid. And then, of course, it's all theirs.
So this is a really, really important philosophical question. And again, I think I need to remind people like this isn't for everyone, but so if this doesn't appeal to you, then no worries. But there's an interesting trade-off here. Somebody might be listening to this and they go, Ryan, you're giving this away too easily. 30 years of business and you're basically doing a low multiple. You're doing a 2x of EBITDA on a 3-year average plus book value. Oh, and by the way, if they can't come up with all the money, I'll also like seller finance it, vendor finance it as well. Seems like a pretty good deal for this, you know, this young employee who's been working there for 5 years. And yeah, they're good, but they haven't put in the work that you have. I mean, there's really a strong case you could make that you're giving too much away. But on the flip side, I'm just kind of thinking this out loud. On the flip side, what you do get is you have an autonomously growing business that you're largely uninvolved with and still have an equity stake in and still draw from that asset on an annual basis. And you do, I'm not going to say nothing, but you are very uninvolved with that business. So it's like, yeah, I might be giving away a little bit up front. You could certainly make that case, but there is this whole other back half, this longer term vision or chapter to the story that I think people ignore when they're too myopic about the multiple.
Yeah, well, just think about that. If the business grows and I stay in at 20%, there's no one saying I have to sell my 20. If the business grows, my 20 could be worth the same as the 100,
right?
You know, 3 years ago.
Right.
And the bottom line is, and you saw it in the guys that you met down in Orlando, both those guys, and one of them in particular is chomping at the bit to get ownership, right? Mm-hmm. And the other one, at the middle of winter, I met them. I ran into him at the Home Depot parking lot, and him and his wife, they both work for us. And we were talking about the profit share, went really well last year. Can't wait to get back to work in the spring. And by the way, we're not going anywhere.
Yeah. That's really sweet.
When an employee tells me that in the parking lot of the Home Depot, that they're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's better than money.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally feel that. And I think, again, it's just some people who personally gravitate towards that, and it's a core value, and that's really important. Maybe others are a little bit more capitalistic about it. And I have zero judgment about either route. You can be successful with both. How are the partners selected? Because that's obviously a really big decision. Is it done by committee? Is there some sort of democratic system where there's votes? I mean, it's not just like anybody can buy, you know, a tranche of the business whenever they want. You guys, the previous owners, must have some sort of system for deciding who's eligible and who's not.
Yeah, and we do. And, you know, and we operate very similar in a very similar model culturally to a co-op or an ESOP. Mm-hmm. It's just in Canada, our ESOPs really haven't evolved, and there's no big government support or drive to get them implemented like there is in the US, tax benefits, et cetera. But so we're just a limited company that kind of operates on a consensus basis. On an annual basis, we will decide whether or not we're accepting applications. We already have in our mind a year or two in advance who we need to bring in and teach more, a little extra on the leadership side.
It's like a 30, maybe 40 person. This isn't a massive business. It's small enough that you kind of know who's who, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I could see us still knowing that even at 100, just because of the way we operate. It's very inclusive and transparent and involved. So at any rate, getting back to that, there's the process. There's a mind map. Everyone has a view of that map, the process, path to partnership. They have to go through a whole visioning exercise. They have to talk about the core values, what it means to them. They have to propose. They have to talk about their ownership and the last guy we brought in, Zach, he did a great job. When I read his, I almost cried when I read, and he had been with us 6 years out of high school. At 24, he became a partner, and the things he wrote about what that meant to him just told us. And we do have the right of refusal, right? So, and we don't have to take on somebody every year. There's going to be different triggers. You know, sometimes we don't want to just lose anybody, but we don't want to just hold them in a headlock because we don't want to lose them. If they're not right for the position or they're not in that space in their life, then, you know, we either help them or help them get to there, or we just push it off a year or two, perhaps.
Have you had to do that? I mean, we don't need to tell personal stories, but just in general, have you had to have tough conversations where somebody's really chomping at the bit to buy in and you go, hey, you know, this isn't the right fit, or you're not ready, or, you know, what? I mean, those are delicate, emotional, and I hate to say it, but they are kind of personal conversations. Have you had to have any of those in the past?
Yeah, I think the only one we've really had to have so far is that the company's not ready to take another person on. The pie's not big enough to share more.
Right.
Right. And, you know, we've already divided that pie up, on the ownership side, as much as we can. So there's another trigger is company growth. So the people who are going to get the opportunities, Benji, to participate in ownership are the ones that are helping the company grow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So potentially they're becoming kind of a managing partner, which is what my son did. And I didn't get to vote him in. That was an all owner vote. And he came in, he drives the entire maintenance division.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was a natural fit.
Is there a time period that you guys are stuck? Like, hey, they need to be in the business for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. Is it case by case?
Yeah. I would say it's going to be three years.
Yeah.
I would suppose in everything, nothing's completely black and white. But we'd like to see people with us for 3 years.
In your 2030 forecast, do you have a number? Do you have a sense for how many partners, how many owners a business could support if things go your way and you hit the goals you want to hit?
Yeah, I think looking up on the chart that we have up there in our long-term plan, there's about 12 partners and about 60 employees. We think about a 20% ratio.
Like one owner to five employees, or one owner to four employees. Yeah.
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 One owner to five, I would say is better. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting. Any closing thoughts here before we wrap up? Like, is there any parting wisdom, any advice, any perspective you can share with someone who's listening to this and kind of like curious about the whole idea?
Yeah. Good one. I think with every set of hands, Benji, you get a free brain. And I would highly recommend you not waste that opportunity to engage people at a level where they can actually contribute at more than one thing. The second notion to that is we say a 1+1 equals a lot.
Right.
When you give somebody their one job and then you add something else in there that is not related to that job, maybe it's like Jordan, like you met, and he's in charge of the strong relationships, which is directly related to the culture of the company. When you give them those two things, it doesn't equal two. It really doesn't. You know, especially if you can make it fun and just give them the laneway to run with it.
Every set of hands comes with a free brain. I think that's such a great mantra. Where can people dig deeper on this subject matter? Can you maybe give people like the, I don't know, the starter pack of books or podcasts or speakers or websites? Like what, someone wanted to just go and self-educate on this a little bit more. You can tell everyone what you're up to as well with RMark, but just, sure. Yeah.
Okay, so I'll start with that. When I went down there to Springfield, Missouri, 17 years ago, something like that, I came back, said, I'm going to run my company this way. And I joked with the vet president and the vice president at that time. And we hired one of their coaches, by the way. And I said, one day I'm going to become your first Canadian coach. And I did. About 3 years ago, I got certified as a Great Game of Business coach. I'm the only one in Canada at the moment. And I'm the only one from the green industry and out of about 75 of us worldwide. So I really enjoy that. And I like talking about this stuff. And I like to take people to the level that took us 10 years because we messed around with it so much.
Yeah.
And it's evolved so much with regards to the body of work that's behind the Great Game. And this is almost 40 years worth of work. And it's evolved so much that I can take people through that. Remember I said there was three stages, mm-hmm. design, play, sustain. The first two stages is really what you need to get rolling on. So you're up and you're on the field, you're playing your game with your people in about 6 months. Mm-hmm. So my website is RMARK, which is RMARK.ca. And you can find out a little bit more about us, about me and what I'm doing. But also, you know, Great Game of Business book, mm-hmm. greatgame.com. The one I gave you, which is a fantastic book, Get in the Game. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some 90-day quick start challenges there. And you know, you don't have to, I'd like to say you have to do it all or nothing, but it's really not the case. I mean, you're not going to learn all the plays in a game all at once anyway. So, you know, you can read, you can pick up on stuff, you can play some mini games, you can do some short-term improvement challenges.
Yeah.
If any of your listeners want to reach out to me and chat a bit more about that, then, you know, feel free.
I think they will. That's why we wanted to have you on. I've had a few listeners ask specifically about this, and then we crossed paths and here we are. So dude, let's leave it at that. I think that's a perfect little intro to open book management, how it works, why it works, what it's done for you at Creative Roots. I really want to thank you for your time, and I'll see you back in Kelowna soon.
All right.
Thanks, brother.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for watching this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our channel, consider sharing this episode with another contractor who you think needs to hear it.
Paynet podcasts are produced by the Painting Contractors Association and are made possible by members and industry partners. To find out more about upcoming education opportunities or for more information about joining PCA, visit pcapainted.org.